Welcome to Literary Speaking with Crystal Lee Quibell. Literary Speaking is the author's guide to writing and publishing, sharing tips and tricks for aspiring authors. Crystal Lee's expert guests will bring you the latest information on how to write and publish your book into being. Are you ready to tell your story? Here's your host.
Welcome to Literary Speaking. I'm your host, Crystal Lee Quibell, and today we're speaking with Elizabeth Bard. Elizabeth is the author of two delicious food memoirs. Her first, Lunch in Paris, A Love Story with Recipes, became a national bestseller, and her second, Picnic in Provence, a memoir with Recipes, is available now. Elizabeth, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Crystal. It's great to be here.
You know, in your first book, Lunch in Paris, it became a bestseller and has sort of what I feel is one of the best opening chapters I've read in a memoir. You combine love and food and sex and Paris all at once. And I think it's the way you describe how you sort of eat and make things look and how it reacts on the plate. And it just makes it such a juicy read. And Picnic in Provence is really sort of the continuation of Lunch in Paris as you navigate your new life. How different was it to sort of switch from the busy lifestyle in Paris to sort of southern France?
Well, I'm kind of a city girl by nature, but I do have to go back to Paris and go back to New York on occasion to kind of get my sushi fix and my museum fix and my window shopping fix. But I think, you know, Provence is, it was a wonderful sort of set of unexpected choices for us. And I think we may have slightly missed the relaxing part of Provence, because very soon after coming here, my husband and I started a business. We started a Scaramouche, an artisan ice cream business down here. So we're actually busier than I've ever been in my entire life. Like, we work more hours than any New York lawyer that I've ever known. You know, it's so I think we may have slightly missed the relaxing part of Provence, but it's, you know, it's chasing the dream. So it doesn't, you know, most days it feels like chasing the dream. So.
And what really inspired you to write food memoir of all the types of memoir there is, you know, this to me was the most perfect sort of memoir for foodies and people that are just big fans of Paris and that sort of dream lifestyle. What made you want to write about food and memoir?
Well, I think that probably as soon as I got into an international relationship with my soon-to-be French husband. When I moved to Paris in 2002, I was doing some art journalism at that point. I'm trained as an art historian, and I think I knew almost as soon as I arrived in Paris that I wanted to write about international living, write about intercultural relationships, because it's such a roller coaster. And when I kind of sat down to think about how I really learned about France, what were the key moments of my discovery of French culture, almost everything that I came up with revolved around food, around a meal, around a recipe, around a trip to the market, around going on vacation with my in-laws, about meeting family and friends. And so almost everything that helped me discover French culture, I kind of discovered what they call in France autour de la table, right, around the table. And mm-hmm. so the recipes just kind of fit. It was a very, very natural structure for the book. And once I decided to focus on those food experiences, the rest of the structure kind of fell into place.
And I love how you, in each of the books, there's story and then there's several recipes that were mentioned in that chapter. And it sort of feels like somebody's inviting you into their home and cooking for you as you read. Did you always plan to write memoir and bring the recipes into it as well?
I'm not sure that I always planned to write anything. I always wrote in whatever environment that I was in, and whatever job that I had, writing was always a part of it. But I think I've always used food to discover other cultures. Like, I was always that kid that when you went on a trip somewhere wanted to go into the foreign supermarket and look at the weird tins of octopus and artichokes and look at the different girls on the shampoo bottles. So I think food has always been a conduit for me. I'm kind of an experimental eater. I like to try new things, and so food was always a conduit to other cultures for me. So I think that made it natural to include it in the discovery of my adopted culture as well.
And how long did it take you to write each book? Like, I'm sure they're different on their own, but how long did you find the process to write and add the recipes and that kind of thing?
Well, you know, memoir in particular, first, right, before you can write about it, if you're writing from your own experience. I think that I probably spent a couple of months on each proposal, so putting together a detailed outline, figuring out exactly what I wanted the structure to be, and then probably another year to year and a half on each manuscript and the recipe testing.
Mm-hmm. So you did the format where you put together a proposal and some sample chapters before anything, and you pitched that to agents?
Yes, because I think that the most nonfiction is sold in that way, at least in the States. So I was, you know, I had friends that had written books before that, and actually who had written memoirs before that, you know, helped me outline the proposal and help, you know, knew which elements I needed to put in there. And there's, you know, there's sample chapters, there's a very detailed outline, there's a marketing plan, there's a comparative titles section where you kind of figure out where this book fits into other titles that have been successful. Of course, when you're talking about France and Paris, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of books because that sparks a lot of people's interest. Paris is one of those, you know, perennial topics.
Exactly.
It always works.
Exactly. Well, everyone, you're listening to Literary Speaking with Crystal Lee Quivel, and today I'm speaking with author Elizabeth Bard. When we come back, we'll discuss how she published her food memoirs, Picnic in Provence and Lunch in Paris, navigating a writer's life of love and food in southern France, and what's next for Elizabeth. We'll be right back.
What does your vivid life look like? What does it feel like to be living a vivid life every single day? How do you start? What's the first step for you personally to make the shift that you've been seeking? Find out now. Vivid Life. It's a happier, healthier, wealthier state of being. Get there today by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribing to our free inspirations in your inbox at vividlife.me.
Your story is begging to be told, but do you know where to start? Crystal Lee Quivel is dedicated to helping you achieve your book publishing dreams. Go to CrystalLeeQuivel.com. That's Crystal Lee Quivel, Quivell.com, and sign up for Crystal Lee's newsletter today.
You're listening to Vivid Life Radio Talk Radio that connects you to the most current, optimistic, and inspiring conversations on the planet. Get ready to be catapulted into your happiest, healthiest, and wealthiest life ever. Go to vividlife.me. That's vividlife.me for details on our previous and upcoming conversations with the world's brightest minds sharing their wisdom for happier, healthier, and wealthier lives.
Welcome back to Literary Speaking. I'm your host, Crystal Lee Quivel, and we're continuing our conversation today with Elizabeth Bard, author of Picnic in Provence and Lunch in Paris. Elizabeth, what was it like to write in Paris?
Well, Paris is a great city of cafes, and I don't get any work done in the house. So I basically wrote my entire, well, both books actually, in different cafes. And my neighborhood in Paris, my old neighborhood in Paris, was along the Canal Saint-Martin. So it's a really mixed neighborhood with lots of different immigrant groups and, you know, lots of busy commercial streets and shops. And I kind of picked a couple of cafes, and I would I was usually the lone woman in these cafes because they weren't sort of she-she cafes. There was often a lot of soccer on the television and people speaking Arabic around me. And I got a couple of, you know, very nice waiters that sort of would just take care of me, and then I sort of became an habitué of the different cafes, and so they, you know, they got used to having me around, and it became actually rather protective of me. One cafe where I used to work was around the corner from our house. It was actually called Le Carillon, the cafe that was actually attacked in the November attacks in Paris. It's about 50 meters from our apartment in Paris. That was our sort of go-to place. And there was a lovely Macedonian waiter who, you know, used to take care of me, and he was very friendly. And my husband once went there with on a Sunday morning with a colleague, you know, to have like a business meeting. And the Macedonian waiter comes up to him and says, you know, what are you doing? Where's your wife? And so his colleague said, "Maman, tu vas faire des conneries, tu les fais ailleurs," you know, meaning like if you're going to do anything stupid, you better do it somewhere else because you're being watched. That's what it's like to write in a cafe in Paris.
Well, I love that. When you ended up writing Picnic in Provence, your life had obviously changed from the early days of Lunch in Paris. How did you find writing different when it came to the second book?
I think Picnic in Provence, my second memoir, was harder. It was a harder book to write. It's a slightly different voice, more mature, obviously, because it's written, you know, a couple of years apart. I was writing about many different issues, about professional transitions, personal transitions, city to country transitions, particularly about becoming a mother, which was not an easy transition for me at all. And so I felt like it was very important, particularly when I was writing about new motherhood, to really get to the bottom of that for myself. I knew that my son would someday read this book. And I thought it was important to get to the bottom of it emotionally so that I could be responsibly honest for myself and for him, and do it in a way that I felt was the best possible and the most honest possible way that I could do it.
And, you know, we were talking a bit before the break about book proposals. And I know early on I had received the advice that because I had no platform, I should write the entire book before I shopped it. But you actually went through the process of doing the book proposal. And now it's recommended for many memoirists to do this. So what was your experience with the proposal process?
Well, I had had a very, very close friend who I continue to work with. You know, she's my touchstone and my mentor, who had written a memoir previously, and she guided me a lot in the proposal process. I had been working as a journalist for a couple of years, an arts journalist, so I did have some clips to show around with the proposal. I'm not sure how much good that did. The proposal process is very useful, even if you're not going to sell it off of a proposal. I think the proposal process is useful because it forces you to do a very, very detailed outline, and really make sure that the structure and the narrative arc is intact and really works. It also forces you to explore in the sort of what they call the comparative title section where your book fits into the marketplace. Are there a lot of books like it? How does it fit into that marketplace? Is it different? Is it better? Is it an extension of? So all of that, it's a very useful exercise.
And so once you had finished the proposal, how many agents did you approach?
I got pretty lucky. I went on a trip to New York in January of 2008, and I saw, I don't know, I'd say like maybe 5 or 6, 7, 8 people. And the thing about finding an agent is that there are lots of different types of agents, and I think everybody looks at your idea and everybody thinks that it should be changed, but everybody thinks that it should be changed in a different way. And you really have to, a literary agent is probably one of the most, it's like having a psychiatrist, it's one of the most personal relationships that you can get into. What I found was that people were looking at the proposal and saying, oh, this is great, but there needs to be more conflict. It needs to be more mean. It needs to be more bitchy. It needs to be more art worldy. And everybody wanted to change it to highlight a different aspect. And honestly, I just got dumb luck, which I've had a lot of dumb luck in my life. I actually met my current agent, Wendy Sherman, through a family friend at a shiva call. So if people don't know what a shiva call is, that's a sort of a Jewish wake, mm-hmm. basically after a funeral. An old friend of my stepfather's had passed away, and the man who passed away, his daughter was a literary agent, and of course, my stepfather. And adorable, said, oh, my daughter's writing a book, and handed, telling this to this poor widow. And, of course, I'm sure that Wendy thinks, oh, my God, another proposal that she has to read from some friend of the family, that thinking, oh, this is, I have to be polite about this because it's a friend of the family. And it actually turned out to be, it's been one of the most important working relationships of my life.
That's amazing. So, in terms of the publishing process, was there a difference? I mean, publishing food memoir especially, is there anything that somebody that's looking to write a food memoir should consider when they're about to go into this and to know, the length of time it takes, from beginning to on the bookshelf?
Well, I think that, that's a process to discuss with the publisher. I think like writing any book, and a food memoir is no exception, you really have to know what you want to say, because the food just has to be in a food memoir an extension of the story, right? You have to have a story that you want to get across, and the food has to be reflective of those experiences. So I think it has to be an integral part of the story.
And for you, once you got your agent, how long did the two of you work on the book together before sending it out to editors and publishing houses?
We worked on the proposal together for about 2 months, and she had some really good criticisms and some very interesting comments. She's a very, very savvy, you have to have somebody also who knows the public that you're trying to address. Particularly living in Europe, I'm very, very cut off from the habits of the audience that I'm trying to address. So to have somebody who really understands that and understands the marketplace is incredibly important. So we worked on it for about 2 months, and then she sent it out. But she knew, a good agent knows exactly who they're sending it to. They know exactly who it's for.
Yeah.
So, she knew exactly who it was for, and I think we signed in 4 or 5 days. It was a basically instantaneous process with Lunch in Paris. And I've remained with the same editor, Judith Klein at Little Brown, since then. And so we're working on the third book together now.
That's so exciting. Are you allowed to tell us anything about it?
Sure, no, it's not, classified top secret.
I love secrets.
I decided that I wanted to do something that was a synthesis of everything that I had learned about French eating habits and French ingredients since I'd been here. So I'm working on a sort of little book of tips and tricks called Dinner Chez Moi, sort of 50 ways to make your kitchen more French, and it's going to include different kinds of French ingredients that maybe a North American audience doesn't think of as readily as the French do, like leeks and lentils and almond flour and vanilla beans, and also the way that the French structure their meals, the cheese after dinner as opposed to before dinner, the way we do it in the States, different ideas for the apéritif, what the French do for drinks before dinner, just different ideas about how they eat with kids, because there's certainly French culture has its problems, and there are ways when there are times when the sort of tradition bound aspects the dogmatic aspects of French culture can be very frustrating, but in where food habits are concerned, it's actually incredibly, incredibly healthy and useful.
Mm-hmm. I know last year when I visited Paris for the first time, I felt amazing. I mean, the food and just the lifestyle itself, I came home and I was just like, oh, if I could live like that every day, you know? So it's nice to be able to have a book that can teach you how to bring that into the everyday, no matter where you are in the world.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to do. And that's going to be coming out next April with Little Brown. So we're working on that. I'm working on it right now. I'm testing Madeleine recipes and crepe recipes and
yum,
you know, salad dressing. Just really, but silly stuff that mm-hmm. Particularly Americans, I don't know if it's the same in Canada, don't seem to think about. We have a salad dressing aisle in an American supermarket, and I don't know if it's the same in in Canada, but the French, like, why would you buy salad dressing? You know, I was this close to calling this book "French Women Don't Buy Salad Dressing." That was that was my working title for this book, because it's simple things like that: olive oil, vinegar, salt, and there you go.
Exactly. Sometimes it's the simplest food that has the best taste. And it's like in Lunch in Paris, when you were writing about, you know, the first meal that you shared with your now husband, and he was just taking bits out of the freezer, and you were like, he opens the fridge and it looks bare to you, and he's like, oh, there's plenty here. We can make a beautiful meal. And he makes you this amazing meal, and you're like, what's the recipe? And he's like, there is no recipe. You just make it.
He still does that. It's so, I mean, lovable and yet frustrating, because, you know, he makes crepes all the time for us, because he's, you know, and he makes crepes, and I, every time I ask him for the recipe, because I have to write this stuff down now, I have to write it down in metric, mm-hmm. I have to write it down in imperial, it has to be exact, and he can't help me at all, you know, he doesn't know how he does it, he just kind of, so he's terribly, you know, lovable and really unhelpful for my recipe testing.
And did you, I mean, you clearly have to test the recipes and go through. Did you have any beta testers or beta readers that went through your manuscript and kind of tried some of them before you published?
No, I haven't. I mean, I've had friends occasionally do it. Do things, and I've certainly had feedback from readers after the books are published, which is great. It's always nice to know and to see pictures on social media of how things come out in other people's kitchens. That's always fun. But no, I haven't done a specific beta testing program.
What do you feel was possibly the best writing advice you've sort of ever received or would want to share with other writers?
Well, I came to writing books from the world of journalism, so I was very comfortable with being edited from the beginning, and I think it's important to listen to your editors. Nobody writes in a vacuum, nobody reads a book in a vacuum, and you know, if something is unclear to an editor, it's not that you have to make the change their way, but think about how you might make their change your way. And on the flip side of that, you know, when somebody comes in or a copy editor comes in and wants to change a comma that you think is super important, fight for that comma. You know, it's mm-hmm. it may be the most important thing that, you know, in your work. So I think there's a balance of listening and then fighting for what you believe is your vision of the story. And the other thing that I do that's always been very helpful for me, because I write in a conversational tone, is that I read mm-hmm. everything aloud. Everything.
Mm-hmm. That's
every
a good
chapter,
that's every really
sentence,
good advice.
If it doesn't sound right, out it goes.
Exactly.
That's, you know, it has to, you know, trip off the tongue, as it were.
Well, yes, and it's funny when you do read your work aloud, it's so different than when you're just rereading it, you know, quietly going through it, because you catch all those little sort of nuances and things that may not work, you know, when someone else is reading it, it would be jagged or cut off somewhere and just some things that you miss too. So I think that's probably the best writing advice I've ever received as well. And it's super important for editing. If people could take away one thing from Picnic in Provence, what would you hope it to be?
I think that Picnic in Provence is a book about unexpected choices and about how sometimes those can be the best choices we can make. That's what I would hope that people would take away from it.
Excellent advice. Well, thank you so much for being here today, Elizabeth, from all the way across the very large pond. I'm so grateful to have you as
a
guest.
Thank you.
Everyone, Elizabeth.
This has been really lots of fun.
Oh, I'm so glad we had so many giggles, and I would love to have you back when the third book is coming out. I'm sure people would love to hear about it again as well. Thank you. Elizabeth Bard can be found online at elizabethbard.com. That's Elizabeth, B-A-R-D.com. You can win a free copy of Picnic in Provence by visiting my website at crystalleequible.com. That's Crystal, LeequiBell.com, and sign up for our newsletter. Winners will be notified weekly on our Facebook page, and be sure to tune in next week for more tips and tricks on how to write and publish your book. Thank you for listening, and do keep writing.
Thank you for listening to Literary Speaking with your host, Crystal Lee Quibell. To start discovering how you can begin telling your story, go to CrystalLeeQuibell.com. That's Crystal Lee Quibell, Q-U-I-B-E-L-L.com. And sign up for Crystal Lee's newsletter. Join us again next week for more advice from your favorite authors and publishing professionals.
What does your vivid life look like? What does it feel like to be living a vivid life every single day? How do you start? What's the first step for you personally to make the shift that you've been seeking? Find out now. Vivid Life. It's a happier, healthier, wealthier state of being. Get there today by following us on Facebook, Twitter, or subscribing to our free inspirations in your inbox at vividlife.me.